All right. Let's go ahead and get back to work today here. Okay, so we basically then would begin with what are called the Vedas, which are the oldest. I should say they're actually among, if not the oldest, religious texts in the world. They have a series of poems and sayings and instructions in them to make sure that the Brahmin class is able to the priestly class is able to do the rites and ceremonies that are prescribed inside of them. These Vedas actually were handed down, and they still are, verbally. And then they were finally written down 200 years ago. There are priestly rites that don't get performed very often, and those rites are actually themselves, they're prescribed to a certain extent inside the Vedas, but not every single aspect of them is written down. Those things have to be given from father to son, right? Because once you're a Brahmin, a priestly class, when you're born into that, it's a male priestly class, and it passes from father to son. The sons are supposed to learn all of the knowledge of the Vedas and study the Upanishads together and know the rites and the rituals.
So the Veda is in a form of a book or not?
What?
Veda is in a form of a book?
It is in a form of a book now, but there's always more information to it. It's just like the Talmud. There's a lot of verbal information. So like if you actually were to look at the books of Moses, sometimes Moses would say, you know, you'll take the goat to sacrifice him as it has been prescribed. But it doesn't say anywhere in there how it's prescribed. So these things must have been passed down in the Levite among the priests, right? The same thing with the Vedas. There'll be areas in there where there'll be the hymns will be there, but how the rituals are supposed to be performed is not necessarily there. In some areas, there's some detailing of the rituals. In other areas, there's nothing there. And so, very interestingly, there's a ceremony. I can't remember what ceremony it is. It doesn't get performed very often at all. And they did one in 1973, and they allowed anthropologists to film it. And what was really interesting about it was that these Brahmins were walking through the performance of this ritual, and they were talking to each other, but nothing they said made any sense. It wasn't a language that anybody knows. It was just, it's kind of, you know, like how we were reading that indigenous people keep their secrets. They don't tell everyone about, you know, their ideas. But Brahmins actually have kept a lot of verbal knowledge. And they just pass it down from father to son. Yeah?
So you said they were speaking to each other. It wasn't a language that anyone could understand?
No, they were following through on rituals, and they were doing certain things. And so there was no indication of how anybody knew how to do anything. And
so
there was
a language that like they knew amongst each other. But no.
Maybe it might not even be a language. That was another aspect of it. The anthropologists were a little stumped as to whether it was even a language. It might actually just be rhythmic patterns. So that they all know the things that they're supposed to do, but they do these kind of like rhythmic patterns. So the Brahmins actually, certain Brahmanic schools or certain Brahmanic families may have different rhythmic patterns. Just like if you go to Africa to certain villages, they have different rhythmic patterns for their percussion, right? And you can detail, you know, different things that are done and said through the percussion inside of, you know, different villages in different aspects of Africa. It's probably close to that. Yeah. Which actually reminds me of, really quickly an aside, those Sufis I'm always talking about, the Muslim mystics, they actually believe that human beings began to exchange verbally with each other. They teach that the verbalization didn't make any sense, but the people were always making noises at each other. And, you know, and so really you can almost say that in one sense, language happens when a noise has a meaning that stays, right? So one of the things, you know, like I was saying, the Sufis have the whirling dervish thing where they get all whipped up and they start in circles. They also have another one where they stand in a circle. There's the circle, and they just, what Christians would call talking tongues at each other. They just, and they all just get worked up doing that. And then at some point, some meaning comes out of it. So it could be very well that these notions, that the Brahmins actually have kept a practice that's how people began to share and exchange with each other verbally in the first place. And it's still caught inside of their rituals that are handed down by word of mouth, by word of mouth. And then, of course, these different things became different schools of thought. It's possible the Vedas actually predate the Indus Valley civilization. It's possible that they're not a predate of the Indus Valley civilization. So this is, the Indus Valley civilization was extant and at its height, 2500 BCE to 1500 BCE. That puts it 3500 to 4500 years ago. In one sense, we're still, the Indus Valley civilization is closer to us than it is itself close to that it's about equidistant maybe between, no, it's closer to us than it is to that civilization that was extant, that was the stone circle builders, right? During the period of time, probably the Vedas began to be passed along, the rituals. The Indus Valley civilization is probably the result of one of those invasions by Indo-European peoples from the Caucasus regions, from the steppes, where they invaded down into India, into Persia, and into Europe. Aryans, what they're originally called. We've mostly stopped using that word thanks to the Nazis. Aryan, I can't remember exactly what Aryan means. Aryan means, actually I think it means close like the well-born. So they were invaders. Now what you see here is a picture, it's a very interesting picture of a stela. It was a little stylus that would have an imprint on it that you would run across something until I say, you know, this was purchased by this person, or this belongs to this person, or this was done at that time. That's what they were used for, at least in Mesopotamia. We don't know what they were used for there. We can't translate anything really from the Indus Valley civilization much. What's interesting about it is, look at that. 4,500 years ago, this person's sitting in a yoga posture. And so these figures are called proto-Shivas. Proto-Shivas. That just lost all of its ink, and I thought it was brand new. So these figures were called proto-Shivas. They look a little bit like Shiva. They also, interestingly enough, look a lot like the hunter gods that the pastoral invaders in Europe worshipped with the horns. And what's really kind of cool about it, too, is it shows, you know, the different fauna that are present there. There's tiger and rhinoceros. I think a lion or maybe, no, that's an ox. So tiger, rhinoceros, ox, these are all indigenous to that area. They may have already been there. More than likely they weren't. More than likely there was something they came about by the invaders coming into the region, doing what invaders usually do, oppressing the people that they invaded, taking over the land. It could very well be that the people who are called the unclean in India are related to, as a caste, the untouchables are actually holdovers of the people who had been living there as indigenous before the Indo-Aryan or Indo-European invaders. But we don't know if the Vedas actually were something they took over, more than likely not. One of the gods that's extremely important inside the Vedas is the god Indra. Indra is sort of a parallel to Zeus in the Greek pantheon and to Thor in the Norse pantheon. Pan, Theon, all gods. So the idea that the Vedas actually were written by the people who invaded is more contested now, I think, than what it originally was. So it could be that what they did was they invaded and they took over the Vedic traditions. It's really kind of interesting because it's another one of those, maybe sooner or later they'll figure out a way to decipher the language. Like, it took a while. It's only been like in the last 20 years that we began to be able to decipher the Mayan language. So maybe they'll figure out how to do it. The artifacts that we do have left over from the Indus Valley civilization seem to have a great deal of religious significance in how the society was ordered. They seem to have had ritual baths, ritual communal baths for cleansing. The Vedas themselves, like I said, are sacred hymns. A lot of sacred hymns. Now this is an interesting. Here you get into one of those interesting bits of metaphysicals. There are some people who say that the Vedas were revealed to someone, right? And let's see if we can. If we can all kind of parse this out together, there are some people who say the Vedas were revealed from a divine source, and there are some people who say that the Vedas have always existed and are the expression of being itself, and that there's not a revelation of them. They've just spoke themselves through people. So in other words, the difference here is there was some entity that revealed the Vedas and practices to somebody who then exchanged them and passed them on to someone else. But then there are people who say, no, no, the Vedas, whatever they are, they always have been and they always will be. And they were not revealed from someone to someone, but they simply are, and they came into being, and people understood.
Isn't that what the Brahmins believe in? To look into oneself?
It really depends on the.
Because what the Brahmins talk about is they go inside themselves and look for the answer to themselves.
Right, it's there. And so the revelation happens, but is it a revelation? Is it a revelation from something outside, or is it a revealing or a pulling aside of the reality so that you see the truth, so that you see what things are, which is there already, always.
So, Professor Keith.
Yes.
What is the philosophical answer that people believe in things and they don't even know the origin of those? How can they believe in
Well,
bestsellers.
I mean, you wouldn't. You would. You might read it if you didn't know who wrote it, but
but
definitely
you
think somebody wrote it, right?
But when it comes to religion, how do people believe in books and they don't even know who wrote it?
Well, remember the Vedas weren't books. The Vedas were hymns that were passed verbally, and they only became books about 600 years ago. They were only written down.
So even then.
Yeah.
So what? And how do they know that when they were passed down? All the information was, not mixed up, or everybody understood it, because not everybody has the same intelligence level.
Yeah.
Not everybody can memorize the same way. And people, we know dementia now, people can get at that, at the time too. So how do people answer these questions in philosophy?
Well, in philosophy, I think that we would say, well, it depends on the philosopher. My particular version of philosophy would say, how intriguing. Why do you... Well, actually, I would ask a lot of the same questions that you asked, really. I'd be like, well, but I mean, what if there's a corruption? Usually the responses to these questions are, the thing itself is incorruptible.
Like Socrates never wrote down a lot of the stuff they talked about or whatever, so a lot of his stuff is interpreted through Plato or other students, but I mean, still, in that regard, like you'd say, if you need it written down to say something, that's why it could be just as corruptible as if somebody was to speak it or to say it. So, whether you're transferring like word of mouth or whether you're reading it from like a historical document, the only thing that we see with literature, like any kind of thing you write down, is when you write it down, we can trace like when it was written or when it was written and made. But back in the day, like it wouldn't have been the same way, like you couldn't know how old
it was. And I compare it to, because this is how I've been educated.
Mm-hmm.
That we do not take any saying of the prophet if the chains are not sound. And there's a whole science behind it that, each and every person in the chain is studied. His life history is recorded. If he was suffering with any disease, that is recorded. All of that is recorded. And sometimes there's a saying of the prophet Muhammad, and the saying is very good. If you look at the saying, you want to believe it. But we do not accept it, because if one of the persons in the chain had a problem, so we say, this is a weak narration, it's in the lie. So there's a whole science that goes into it, and there are weak narrations and there are strong narrations, and the weak narrations, they're in the lie. Even though if you just look at them, they might sound humanly very good, but because the chains are weak, and the science through which those chains are established, so that's what I'm comparing it with.
No, I think that's a good way, but I think that you would find that among the Brahmins, one of the things that happens there is they keep each other, when you have a verbal tradition, especially when you have one particular aspect of society who's given over to remembering that verbal tradition, oral tradition, they generally keep each other pretty honest. And so I do know that one thing that they've found is that you can go one thing that they found that was really interesting among people who were doing research is that you can go to Brahma, to Brahmins who are in one part of India and Brahmins in another part of India, and obviously the hidden oral tradition that no one ever passes, the only passes between them you can't say anything about. But the hymns are they don't vary.
And it doesn't bother people that the religion is for an elite group?
It bothers some people. That's why you ended up with Buddhism and Jainism and a different kind of atheism in India. Is that when you say that this one group is the only group who can do these things.
But the religion is for the betterment of the humanity. Why it is secret between just few people?
Well, that's an interesting question. Why would it be? Why do you think it would be? I mean, what's a good? Ben, what would be a response to why a good response to the idea, a positive response to the idea? It's good to have one group of people whose job is to handle religion and to know the texts.
Well, from a practical standpoint, it's more efficient. I think if you have one group of people dedicated to learning the text to distribute to other people.
And let's call it, instead of just also saying text, I mean, text can obviously mean a lot more nowadays after Derrida, but let's just say the tradition, which includes rites, texts, practices,
etc. So it could just be a practical sense that it might just be easier for that person.
Right.
It could also be a source of unity that these people, it might not, through time, it might have been kind of like a hierarchical thing, but whenever it started out, it could have been translated as a unifying thing where everybody comes to this one group and the group kind of just,
right.
I don't know how to explain that.
Well, I think actually, because I think this kind of like, it brings in a contrast enough to what you're asking about and you bringing in Plato, is the idea that originally there are these Vedas, and there are a lot of them, right? And there's no writing. So if you're going to have these Vedas be central to the way that you think about the world and how you do things in the world, and they've got all of the rituals and practices for keeping the gods happy or whatever, then you want to have people who spend their lives, all they do is that, so it doesn't get lost. And there's a little bit of a panic, like, you know, in a village, if it loses its Brahmin, or if there's no, if the Brahmin doesn't have children, or, you know, it can actually lead to some problems. So I think part of the issue is, in the ancient world, pre-writing or pre-using writing for all these rituals and hymns and things like that, it's important to have a specialist who will use that term. It's important to have someone who specialized and kept it alive and kept it and then was able to pass it on to someone else. And in pre-graphic societies, pre-societies before there's writing, you tend to find that sacred traditions and even histories are all oral, and there's always like an elder or two or three, and then they always find an apprentice and they have to pass it on. The problem does become, then the issue becomes sometimes you have to bring in apprentices, you have to bring in elders from other places to test the apprentice to make sure they've learned it the right way. Right? So I think that there actually used to be a lot more checks and balances. Now, it's very important, you know, in one sense that Islam calls, you know, talks about, it is written in the form of a book, and it talks about the people of the book. Because once you actually have writing, now you also have the ability to see something that might have been penned by someone like Muhammad or might have been penned by someone like Paul, and you give preference to that writing, and then you try to figure out what are the other things that might have happened traditionally that you can't pin as much veracity on. Can't put as much veracity on because it wasn't written by the hand of the person who recognizes the authority. And you have to develop these chains
And there's a science that goes into analyzing each and every person. Each and every person's history is recorded. His life, everything is recorded.
Yeah. And this is another one of those things, again, that the Abrahamic traditions, all the Abrahamic traditions have in common with each other, is the emphasis on a written word, that, and then trying to make sure that you can determine the veracity of the chain. Right? It's difficult. And that's why it becomes very important to be able to do that. In this sense, of course, what you've got is... with the Vedas now, going back to that, again, it's possibly the world's oldest scripture. So it's the world's oldest collection of rites and hymns. Because it's not really a scripture until later, right? And inside of it, there are what you would call Devas, gods. You know, our word diva, it derives from that word. Deva, 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 and devil, all derived from that word. And it means a god or a sacred entity. Here are the four of the most important controlling forces in the cosmos. I want to say one more time about this notion of, you know, orderly exchange and the importance of exchange and order. The Greek word for order is cosmos. That's also the root word of cosmetic. Because when you put cosmetics on, you're ordering your face. Right? You don't want to like go off without your face ordered. Right? What woman goes off with her face left at home? At least that's what my drag queen friends always tell me. Anyway, so cosmos means order. And in one sense, it also means beautiful. That's why I was bringing that up. So well-ordered is beautiful. Orderly exchange has a beauty to it, right? We think. Okay, so the controlling forces in the cosmos, the god of thunder and bringer of rains, Indra, who I said, you know, Zeus and Thor. Agni, the god of fire. Fire is super important. That's to me, what's really interesting about Hinduism is that it's what you would call one of the great religions. It's one of the oldest, you know, religions out of a civilization. But it keeps inside of it so many things that you would actually still find in smaller indigenous religions, right? It's interesting that over the course of, you know, 4,000 years as it developed, it kept all these things so well preserved. See, there's, I think, another aspect of what can actually happen in oral tradition. It kept so many of these things so well preserved that you look at it and it's like, oh yeah, I see that in Ghana, you know, this tribe in Ghana, or I see it, you know, with the Navajo do something like this, or and, you know, shamans in Siberia do something similar to this thing here. Soma is an interesting one because people have been trying to figure out for a few hundred years what the hell Soma is, because Soma seems to have been a drug that really did some cool shit, but we don't know what it was. It's probably, maybe it's related to, it's related to ergot. So ergot is the basics for LSD, if you've never heard of LSD. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. I actually went, when I was 4 years old, I went to an acid love-in that my brother took me to in Abilene, Texas. I just remember it being the coolest amount of adults that I'd ever been around because they were so much fun to play with. So I have this really vivid memory of being around about 12 or 15 18 to 22 year olds. They were all just so much fun to play with. But then I found out when I got older that, you know, they'd all been doing their own version of Soma. So anyway, onward and forward, I've lived quite the life, blah, blah. All right. So you go to some of these temple structures today, and you know, you'll also see the priests who are in charge. They've all learned orally and through scripture the diverse things that they're doing. This is a temple to Shiva. It's a really cool temple. There's actually a couple of really cool Indian temples in the DFW area. And one of the ones that I like to visit is the Hanuman Temple in Frisco, of all places. So you're driving along in Frisco, and you know, you make a couple of turns into the city, and you're driving along the street, and all of a sudden you see the statue of a great big monkey god. Right? And it's like, what the hell is that in Frisco, Texas? And it's the Hanuman Temple. And it shares a parking lot with the Lutheran Church. Now, there's America. really, really beautifully kind people. This, of course, is Shiva's North Indian deity. Brahmanas. These are directions for worshiping the deities. The Aranyakas, these are treatises that were done where people went off and they recorded their thinkering from sitting in the forest. Finally, the last aspect with these writings, and the point comes later, it comes around the time of Jainism and Buddhism, are these Upanishads that I opened up today with, one of them. And we're back to kind of these same issues here. Brahman is the supreme reality, Atman is the soul. Now we get to some other aspects, and this is something I think that most of us know. Indians believe in reincarnation. What does that mean to reincarnate?
Live again.
Huh?
To live again.
To live again. But look at that word. What is incarnate mean?
Incarnate.
So living in body incarnate?
Yeah, it's flesh, carne, like chili con carne. Meat. It means to go back into the meat, right? In flesh again, right? But you can in flesh as anything. Ants, anteaters, you can probably reincarnate as ants. That's the way carnal works. No, that's not actually the carnal word. Because now there's that word karma. See, there's some words, like I was saying, like Tao has become almost the kind of word that you don't need to translate because enough people have begun to hear what the word means, Tao, the way, or whatever. But definitely there are some Indian words that have gotten into the English language, like karma and kurd. But definitely like karma, right? Everybody, oh, karma, good karma, bad karma. In one sense, and it becomes quite radicalized in Buddhism, we'll see later, karma is simply the description of cause and effect. You do this, and it has this effect. The issue, of course, is that the effect can last in those ripples of being across more than one inflection, across more than one life. All right? So what you want to do is, you want to examine samsara, the cycle of birth and rebirth, and the structure of karma so that you can mitigate your karma and free yourself from samsara, moksha, liberation. So these are really important concepts to kind of keep in mind so you can demonstrate. I know a little something about Hinduism. That Hindus believe they're monistic. They believe that, you know, all beings are expressions of one being. That Brahman is that supreme reality. They believe in a soul, which is the life force. And it's the soul that incarnates again and again, reincarnates, right? They believe that through this that reincarnation happens because the soul, in its decisions and in its actions, does something that increases a cause-effect cascade that causes life to reincarnate. And that when you get caught in that cycle of incarnation, you have to, of samsara, you have to work to figure out how to liberate yourself, how to achieve moksha, how to achieve liberation. Any being can be caught up in samsara. Right? So the god Indra, one day, was sitting around, and he was thinking about how awesome he was, which he did from time to time. But at this point, he just started thinking about how awesome he was to such a degree that Indra was like, I am so freaking awesome, I need a much better palace. So he called in the lower gods and said, y'all need to make my palace look more like, you know, all fleek, because I'm awesome. And so they began working on his palace. And then it's progressing along, and as the days go by, the months go by, he just keeps thinking about how great and awesome he is. And he's like, this isn't enough, I need more. So he brings in the mid-level gods and says, y'all have got to, like, help everybody here, give me the crib that I deserve to have, because I'm the most awesome. So he's sitting around on his throne while everybody's doing their work. And he notices this old hermit-looking guy come toddling into his throne room. And he just sort of squats down, and he just starts watching something on the floor. Well, Andrew's like, I ain't time for that, because I'm so awesome, I gotta think about my awesomeness, and I need an even bigger castle. Palace. So he's like, then he gets the higher gods involved. He's like, I need all of y'all working on making me the place I deserve to be in, because I am so freaking awesome. So all the higher gods begin working on it too, and they're just going, and by now this palace is just absolutely insane. It's just so huge, and it takes up half the sky, and it's, you know, it's like it would take a millennium to go from one end of it to the next end of it if you were walking quickly. And Indra's just going on, but as the higher gods are spending months and years, and he keeps looking over and seeing this old hermit who's been sitting there this whole time, squatted, looking at the floor. So finally Indra leaves his throne, and he walks to the end of the room where the old man's at. And he's just sitting there while all this stuff's going on. Mind you, he's not been helping build this palace. He's just been sitting there watching the floor. And so Andrew's a little irritated about that. So he wanders over. And he looks down at the floor. And he sits there for a little while, staring at the ground. And he realizes there's just this long trail of ants. And they just keep moving along into this crack and out of this crack, bringing this into it and that out of it, doing their thing. And this old hermit's just squatting there looking at it, just smiling and laughing, and then he starts looking up at Indra. He starts laughing, you know, kind of toothless old thing. He's like, oh. And Indra's like, finally, he's like, hey, what are you doing? I'm awesome, and you should be making my castle bigger. And then at that moment, the old hermit looks up at him, and Indra's caught in the eyes of the hermit. And the hermit reveals himself as Shiva, the dancer and destroyer of worlds. And he says, Indra, 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 don't you know that all of this is just, it's just nothing. It's just gonna all destroy itself and reboot itself again. all these things that you've been doing, Indra, to show how awesome you are will come to naught and they'll all fall apart. You know? And I want you to note this, little Indra. You see these ants? Every one of them used to be an Indra. That moment Indra saw that even gods get caught up in the cycle of death and rebirth. And that if you devote yourself to the wrong actions, you trap yourself in the same cosmic causal nexus over and over again. Right? All right. So tomorrow we'll come back and we will get back. He keeps looking over and seeing this old hermit who's been sitting there this whole time, squatted, looking at the floor. So finally, Indra leaves his throne room, his throne, and he walks to the end of the room where the old man's at. And he's just sitting there while all this stuff's going on. Mind you, he's not been helping build this palace. He's just been sitting there watching the floor. And so Indra's a little irritated about that. So he wanders over. And he looks down at the floor, and he sits there for a little while, staring at the ground, and he realizes there's just this long trail of ants. And they just keep moving along into this crack and out of this crack, bringing this into it and that out of it, doing their thing. And this old hermit's just squatting there looking at it, just smiling and laughing, and then he starts looking up at Indra. He starts laughing, you know, kind of toothless old thing. You know. And Indra's like, finally, he's like, hey, what are you doing? I'm awesome and you should be making my castle bigger. And then at that moment, the old hermit looks up at him, and Indra's caught in the eyes of the hermit. And the hermit reveals himself as Shiva, the dancer and destroyer of worlds. And he says, Indra, 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 don't you know that all of this is just, it's just nothing. It's just going to all destroy itself and reboot itself again. All of these things that you've been doing, Indra, to show how awesome you are will come to naught and they'll all fall apart. You know, and I want you to note this, little Indra. You see these ants? Every one of them used to be an Indra. Whew. That moment Indra saw that even gods get caught up in the cycle of death and rebirth. And that if you devote yourself to the wrong actions, you trap yourself in the same cosmic causal nexus over and over again. Right? All right. So tomorrow we'll come back and we will get back.